It's the Midas edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Catholic baby theft, Weepboard wipeout, and exploring the Midas mind. Let's begin episode 139.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross sword for politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of spark stuff. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello, and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher.
Jenna, your lab rat biochemist.
Lab rat?
You bet.
Okay.
That's what I was for Halloween.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Did you do any experimentations, you know, just to see? I mean, if we're a lab rat.
Just to see if it was Halloween or just to see if that's my job?
Well, you were a lab rat. What do lab rats do? They are involved in tests. The lab rats are not a species of animal that happens to like beakers, so they hang out in labs just for the fun of it all. Or am I wrong? You are the scientist here.
It's hard to say. There might be some lab rats that really do like beakers. You know, maybe it's one of those hyper-stimulating sexual selection things that we were talking about as far as, you know, beetles and bottles. But as far as lab rats go, I think they tend to be on the experimentee side of the experiment.
Oh.
So they're not like those mice and Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy?
Well, not that you know of, anyhow.
Not that I know. And, you know, now that I think of it, maybe I should reclassify myself as lab rat. This has also been taken to be a euphemistic term for someone who spends a lot of time in the lab.
But you spend a lot of time in the lab.
Yeah.
So it's not really euphemistic. It's more what you call accurate.
Well, depending on, you know, whether you think this is a positive or negative thing, it could be euphemistic.
Well, for someone who really enjoys lab work, it's probably quite the enjoyable thing.
For me, it's euphemistic.
Okay.
You know, it's funny, actually, coming to the show today, you know, I take mass transit and all that, right? And I don't know if you guys noticed, but it just seemed really, really crowded on the bus today. And I couldn't quite figure out why. And then I was reading in the paper for the last 3 months that yesterday apparently was the official day for the 7 billionth person on the planet.
Hey, and I didn't get any cake.
Took the bus, I swear.
They may have a big celebration. They don't break out the cake. I mean, when Safeway has an anniversary, they give you cake.
True.
Then Although, again, that's where it comes from.
The hilarious thing is how many countries around the world were celebrating you're the 7 billionth baby. Australia had it. India had it. Bangladesh had it. England had it. I wouldn't be surprised that there wasn't one in Canada that I just hadn't heard about. And it's like, you know, they're going to pick one person and say, you are the 7 billionth person.
It's all your fault.
Yes. Actually, it's funny. I heard on one of my shows that I listened to called The Bugle. And they had, you know, they can imagine how competitive this could be at some hospitals, right? Women sitting there, right, just trying to hold on a little longer, so their child would be the 7 billionth, only to be ripped out of contention because the guy next to them died unexpectedly. So you're actually the 9,999,999th, and then the guy next to you, well, woman next to you, I guess, would give birth.
Well, the people in the morning news this morning were talking about how we all actually have a number that you can look up.
That's right. The BBC put together a counter there. You enter in the year you were born and it tells you what number you were. I don't think it's that accurate, but they have a number of different sources that they've compiled it from, so it's kind of fun.
Well, and probably just about as accurate as 7 billion happening today.
Yeah,
actually, that was a funny thing. I was listening, I'm pretty sure it was Quirks and Quarks, and they had someone who studied these things. I forget whether he was a statistician or a sociologist or one of those types of things, and he said, you know, the 7 billion, it's all really kind of bunk. Because, I mean, some of the data they're relying on are like 20 years old. No one has really done a census of something like Somalia or whatever, so we really don't know how many people are there. And the 7 billionth person may have been born plus or minus 3 or 4 years from this point.
Yeah. You know, it's funny. I've been reading Richard Wiseman's Quirkology, and he's talking about luck. And how people will actually go out of their way to make sure that their babies are born in the quote-unquote lucky months. And they will actually induce labor. They will, what do you call it when you
C-section
to have a baby in the right months. It's not, I wouldn't be surprised if there was someone out there like, I'm going to be the 7 billion. So,
well, yeah. I don't think they would be saying that. I think they'd be saying, I'm going to have the 7 billion.
Yeah, exactly.
Speech development in fetuses, from what I understand, is pretty low.
Well, pretty low.
Well, there can be some really practical reasons to when you have a baby. We were discussing something similar for friends of ours that are have a due date for, I think it's December 28th or something in that neighborhood. And, you know, we were asking, so do you think that people hold off to be the New Year's baby, right? Which we all hear about every year. And apparently they're like, no, pop that sucker out as fast as possible because you get a tax break for the whole year.
That's right. Yeah.
So there you go. There can be some really practical reasons for when you decide to, you know, force that delivery. And then there can be really silly ones like being the 7th billion hypothetical baby.
Yeah. And apparently in the same Wiseman's book, apparently they investigated whether or not people were fudging the rules a little bit and just writing baby born December 30th or whatever. Mm. And apparently it happened.
You should probably aim for the 31st because the 30th is stretching it an extra day.
Yeah.
I was born on the 32nd of November. But, well, you know, it's funny, though. This kind of relates to it. And we're talking about baby births in sort of a sad way, but it'll lead in later. Mississippi is just, I think they're passing a law. They're going to pass a law that states that babies, and I'm going to put the quotes around that, gain human rights from the moment of conception. So literally the moment that sperm meets egg, it has full rights, which means abortion obviously is what they're aiming for, becomes illegal. But things like the morning after pill become illegal because it prevents the
fertilized. What about spontaneous abortion?
Again, would technically, it would be involuntary manslaughter. IUDs, intrauterine devices, would become illegal because they prevent a fertilized cell from taking part. If you've been raped or something like that, again, no. Even if your life is endangered, I don't think you could get an abortion. You just, both of you would have to die because it would be murder for the state to do one way or another. And of course, all of this is based around the fact that the church, religious people, are just nuts when it comes to procreation. They have this big thing about birth, death, and children.
Well, that's a good segue, Don. Thank you. Actually, this goes into the category of news to enrage you. Very recently, the news story broke that the Catholic Church has been stealing babies from families in Spain, often telling them that their baby has died, and then giving or selling the baby to a Catholic or conservative family. And obviously this is incredibly shocking news, and it sounds kind of cartoonishly evil, but it actually was a practice that began in Spain under the fascist dictator Francisco Franco. And it was a way of controlling his political enemies. Their children would be taken at birth and raised by his fascists so that he would be able to, you know, stay in power.
So just for those of us who might not have our fascist dictator years in, you know, coming quickly to mind, around what time period in years is this?
This is so basically from like the 1940s to the 1990s.
Okay.
This is going on.
You, some people may not quite realize that. I mean, we think World War II was the defeat of the fascists in the world, but it really wasn't in some ways. I mean, obviously Hitler and Mussolini were defeated, but one of the other major fascists in Europe at the time was Franco, who was largely put into power by Hitler and Mussolini, was in Spain, but Spain was neutral during World War II, so he actually managed to ride out the World War II, which is why he died in the 70s, I think. Franco died in the 70s, and his form of fascism got transported to places like Argentina, and I think Argentina also had the same sort of practice of, well, they weren't really quite stealing the babies. I mean, part of this was to put fear into the hearts of dissidents. So it was sort of secret, but it was one of those secrets that everyone kind of knew, so you better shut up or they might take your baby sort of thing, right?
It's very similar to sort of taking hostages. You know, you want your political enemy to stay quiet. Well, you take their firstborn and you keep them at your little palace and, you know, they don't cause trouble, right? This was, of course, taking this to the next level. The Catholic Church got involved because Franco, like several other fascist leaders, made some alliances with the Catholic Church. You know, his conservative values really synced up with the church's own kind of oppressive leanings. And Franco would often put the church in charge of various institutions like schools and hospitals. So this gave them access to the newborn babies. Now, as we said, this started as sort of an ideological action. But as Franco kind of solidified his power, that soon changed, and the baby stealing seemed to take on a more sinister tone. It wasn't that they were economically or politically dangerous, but they were actually morally deficient. They weren't good conservative Catholics.
Right. They were, you know, the poor people, and you're sloven and you're lazy and you're not a good influence on the child, or heaven forbid, you happen to be an atheist, which obviously condemns the potential soul of this child. So for the sake of the moral implications, we're going to come in and steal the child and put it into a proper Christian home.
Mm-hmm. So nuns and priests would compile lists of waiting lists of adoptive parents, and the doctors would deliver the baby, then lie to the mother about the fate of the children. In fact, one doctor is accused of telling women that their babies had died when they had not, and handing over those newborn children to couples for cash. A BBC reporter who had recently given birth was trying to book an interview with this doctor, but he obviously wouldn't see her. So she booked an appointment with him at his clinic. When he found out that she was a reporter, he picked up a cross off the wall and shoved it in her face, saying, "Do you know what this is? And I have always acted in his name, always for the good of the children, to protect the mothers." Which I think is just self-serving bullshit. But anyway, the scale of the baby trafficking was unknown until this year, when two men, Antonio Barossa and Jean-Louis Munio, discovered that they had been bought from a nun. Their parents weren't their real parents, and as they put it, their life had been built on a lie. Now, estimations are that over 300,000 babies may have been stolen, and that this baby theft didn't stop until the 1990s. So the scale of this crime is absolutely staggering, and the reports of doctors and nuns selling these babies to rich families, of keeping long-dead babies in the morgue, I guess frozen or something, and then they would wheel these out to convince parents that their child, who had been born healthy a few hours ago, was dead. All over Spain, there have been countless children's graves, which have been exhumed to find that they're either empty or they have some stones in them, or there's no body in there, though. So why has nothing been done about this? Yes.
Because it's the church?
Well, that's part of the reason, probably. It's been mostly kept secret by the government and the church. There's been rumors and hearsay about this sort of thing, but there's never been any real, you know, proof until now. And we now have an admission from the government that this is happening. So other factors have played a role in the secrecy. After Franco's death in 1975, the major political parties agreed to an amnesty to help smooth over the transition to democracy. So any attempt to investigate this as a human rights crime has been rejected because it would violate that amnesty. So in order to prosecute people, we'd have to revoke that amnesty, which would also make it possible to prosecute other war criminals who will most likely try to resist this in any way that they can. Now, as the story is just really starting to get out, we are likely going to be revisiting this from time to time. But I mean, it's a really good example of just, well, this kind of moral bankruptcy that we're being told is, you know, a big, great moral standard in the world, when it obviously isn't.
I'm just sort of intrigued by the comparison that I'm sure would people make between people finding out that they were adopted at a young age when they become adults, and those that find out that they've been involved in one of these scenarios, especially when you were talking about, you know, these two men saying that their life was built on a lie. And I think the biggest differentiation between those two scenarios is that the people that they had known as their parents are actually complicit, not only in the act, as they would be for an adoption, a legal adoption, but actually in the crime of stealing this child from someone else that they're aware of.
Mm-hmm.
And that's got to be some pretty tough news to take for people as they start coming to this reality.
Well, yeah, I mean, we were kind of talking before the show that if you found out that you weren't the biological child of your parents, would that change much? Well, you know, your parents still raised you, they took care of you, but this, of course, means that your parents decided that we're going to take somebody else's child, not because they...
possibly pay for it.
Yeah, because not because this person can't afford to raise it, or they're too poor, or they're too sick, or whatever, but simply because we have more influence in society than they do.
And also that it's not the choice of the biological parents as it is in adoption. You know, whether coerced or not, that parent makes the choice to give up their child, mm-hmm. which is clearly not the case here.
Although there is one other thing I think that kind of blurs this, because again, we said when this originally started out, it was intended to be a political mechanism for control, and at which point I think the parents involved were knowingly the ones who were receiving the children knew what was going on. But I wonder towards the end whether, you know, the church in Spain just had an adoption agency that it had set up, because it's one of the roles that churches mm-hmm. do tend to play in some of these countries, and whether the parents themselves were necessarily aware of the source of these children or not towards the end of the practice.
Or even if they were, whether this was the church's message had been internalized into these people to the point where they no longer, well, they just didn't think that this was wrong, that they believed in the message of this being for the good of the child, this being for the good of society, this even maybe being for the good of the birth parents, that they should, it was their responsibility on some level to take these children.
Well, it's entirely possible. I mean, it does seem that a lot of the parents who received the babies were paying for them, but it is possible that the church might have just said, you know, well, that family is, you know, they're not even Catholic, and this family is Catholic, let's switch the babies or something. It is a possibility. But it's hard to I think, alleviate any responsibility from the perpetrators in this case. I mean, they were in a position of authority that was given to them by this fascist dictator for the purpose of sort of terrorizing people, and mm-hmm. they've kept the process going for their own kind of morality and, that they see in the world. I don't know. It's pretty seedy.
Actually, there's two ways we can go with this, too, now that I think about it. I mean, one of the big claims, you know, against atheists and all that is, well, you know, you guys have no sense of morals or morality. And in an odd sort of way, this does not strike me that you could really justify this as being moral, at least now. At the time, they might have claimed it was. But, I mean, it's like a residential school system here, right? I mean, how could you possibly really defend what you did? What you did, you must admit now, was a horrible act. And if it was a horrible act, then what moral authority can you ever really claim going forward? And then the other idea, which is something we'll probably go back on, is the idea of reparations. I mean, you know, they did do the deed, and people were harmed by it. So should the state and the church pony up and say, hey, we done you wrong and we owe you something?
Well, and on a sort of similar level, I'm wondering what'll come out now that the scope of the problem has been started to be recognized about the psychological consequences for the children. Because if they were raised in homes, especially as Don was saying, in later years of this process, in actually loving homes, regardless of how that relationship started out, I'm wondering whether the statistics on things like abuse and mental distress and stuff is going to bear out that this actually was bad for the children, as obviously the residential school situation did.
Well, I mean, it may be a stretch, but I don't think a stretch for a non-believer that if you had a family that was a non-believing family and you took away their baby and raised it in a religious family and they're brought up within that religious framework and carrying along all the baggage that goes along with it, whether that's homophobia, whether that's racism, I would consider that abuse, but I mean, I don't even going to be able to prove that to anyone else except for a non-believer.
We have to just wait for society to evolve. In the future, it'll all come out in the wash.
Okay. Well, let's go to a commercial break here on Radio Freethinker, and we'll be back with more after this.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Did you know that 30% of students wander from one program to another only to end up dropping out? School doesn't have to be dull. Ktimovik is an informal learning program that offers students the chance to live away from home, explore new options, and learn outside of the traditional classroom. After finishing the program, most Ktimovik alumni return to university motivated and confident in their chosen program and ability to succeed. Visit ktimovik.org for more info or to sign up now.
Science is the best tool ever devised. first. To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. Empowers you. And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, Ethan, I have an interesting story. As many people may or may not know, my birth province was Manitoba, so I have a bit of a link with the prairies. And some interesting things have been going on there with democracy and wheat. I know you probably never think the two intertwined at all, but it does occasionally. Recently, prairie farmers and a plebiscite voted in favor of keeping the Canadian Wheat Board monopoly. Yet, the Harper government is scrapping it anyway, saying that a vote for a majority Conservative government was a vote to scrap the monopoly. Despite Conservative insistence that widespread producer support, producers here being farmers, for getting the CWB, Canadian Wheat Board, as we know it, a solid majority of farm directors who are elected by the farmers themselves in the West have backed the monopoly consistently. Yet Agricultural Minister Gary Ritz stated that, quote, "Let me repeat, regardless of the plebiscite's result, in the end of the day, every farmer will have the right to choose how they market their grain." The Canadian Wheat Board plebiscite had farmers wanting to keep the Wheat Board monopoly at 62% of 55% of the people voting. The Conservatives, conversely, in our last election, as maybe many remember, got 39% out of the 61 people who voted. So somehow, in a weird sort of way, A, every person who voted Conservative, as opposed to Liberal or Democrat, voted only to scrap the Canadian Wheat Board, because that seems to be how he's analyzing it, and B, that 39% somehow is greater than 62%, which strikes me as a lot.
And that apparently a lot of the voters are farmers.
Yes. Well, the most of the support's actually in farmland, so, but most of them are against the Liberals because of oil. Back in the olden days, Trudeau introduced something called the National Energy Program, which was when oil and gas prices peaked. Canada is one of the world's largest producers of oil and gas. So they said, well, it kind of makes sense to help our own industries by selling it cheap to Canadian industries as opposed to selling it at market rate. But of course, all the oil's in Alberta and Manitoba and Saskatchewan, and all the industries were in Toronto, and that caused a slight rift between the East and the West. And ever since then, every farmer in the West is voting against Trudeau and the National Energy Program, even though that was like 1975 or thereabouts. Farmers have very long memories. It's freaky weird sometimes. My grandfather voted for Diefenbaker right up to the year he died, I'm sure. So, the Canadian Wheat Board was created in 1935. It is based in Winnipeg and collectively sells grain on the international market. Because it controls such a large percentage of the wheat, it can command a higher price than individual sellers could. It can also provide a guaranteed price to ensure economic security for Canadian farmers. The Wheat Board came into existence because farmers at the time were at the mercy of large private traders and unpredictable market pricing. After the success of the Grain Board created during World War I, provincial and local co-op grain pools were created, but all went bankrupt in 1929 because of the Depression. The Canadian Wheat Board was created as a national entity as a way to help farmers during the Great Depression and became a monopoly in 1943 as part of the War Measures Act. Now, you might ask why this merits airtime. First, we are broadcast in Winnipeg, right? Which is the home of the Canadian Wheat Board. Also, there are some what I thought were interesting issues about democracy and freedom that could be discussed here. First, the rule of law. The Wheat Board has filed a lawsuit against the Harper government for breaking the act that created the Wheat Board in the first place. As part of that law, the only way a grain could be removed from the Wheat Board is via a plebiscite of the member farmers. And a plebiscite, if it did occur, as I sort of mentioned earlier, would most likely have failed and the monopoly would not be rescinded. However, because a law is just a law, it can be changed or overridden by another law at the whim of a parliament, at least a majority of parliament, a false majority because of our first-past-the-post system, but alas, that's a rant for another day. We in a modern free democracy hold great stake to the idea of rule of law and that no one is above it or can manipulate it. Yet somehow this seems a fiction that, you know, this particular issue is bringing to light that, I mean, laws don't really mean anything if you have a majority government and you want to change things. The other area that I thought was kind of interesting is the official reason for dismantling the nuclear borders claims that it denies some farmers the freedom to sell their grain on the open market. In reality, I think it's a bunch of hooey. We all know it's intended to help Cargill's of the world complete their monopoly, but again, I ran for another day. But there is a valid case to be made that farmers should be able to sell to whomever they wish, and that the government, even one that is supported by the majority of farmers, should not limit that farmer's freedom. So why is it okay? I would argue communal risk. The Canadian Wheat Board provides economic security not only for the members, the farmer members, but for the communities that they live in. It is a limitation of freedom, but I think it is one that would pass the Oak Test, which is what the Supreme Court uses in charter rights challenges. So there's actually sort of a rule of law, to overuse that word, in Canada of how to restrict people's rights and freedoms.
Which you pretty much have to do to have law.
Yes. So basically, you know, there is a common good being served here. The limitation is directly connected to that good, and it is minimal. I mean, a lot of people don't realize, but the Canadian Wheat Board really only deals with two grains, wheat and barley. I know it should be the Canadian Wheat and Barley Board, but and there's no law that actually prevents a farmer from doing one of the other dozen or so crops that actually grow quite good here in Canada. But again, I just thought it was an interesting example of how what we sort of take as sort of assumptions, you know, that if it's a law, the government must follow the law. No, it doesn't really if it doesn't want to. And that, you know, freedom, everyone should have a freedom. And well, yes, no.
I'm a little bit confused as to the Harper government's motivations to scrap the board.
Well, again, the official reason, and I'm... keep me from getting on my high horse because you know I can.
I'll kick you. Your shins are within kicking distance.
The official reason is that there are a number of farmer groups who think that if they could only market their grain, in particular wheat or barley, because it's the only thing that we're dealing with here, and command a higher price on the international market. Whether that's true or not is.
But why does the government care?
Well, the government, like I say, we have the Wheat Board, says that all grain, all wheat, all barley in Canada must be sold through the Canadian Wheat Board.
Yeah.
Right? And the benefits of that is you get a guaranteed price and there's security. Right? I mean, that's a big trade-off for limitations. So the government says, well, no, we are free marketers. We think the free market is the best thing in the world. Everyone should be forced to sell on their own, whether they want to or not, sort of thing.
Well, it just sort of seems like for them to even get involved in this that's been entrenched for a while, that people are actually against, that there would need to be some sort of political motivation to make this push. And I have no idea what that might be.
Well, okay, so the other side of the story is that when you go to other areas of the world that don't have wheat boards, and there's a few of them do, some of them don't, there are usually one or two major corporations that control the vast majority. In the United States, about 20 to 30% of all the grain produced in the United States is owned and sold by Cargill. Right?
So is that sort of like dairy in Canada? Where, I mean, it's not illegal to sell your dairy separately as long as you meet all the requirements and blah, 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 which make it very difficult, but... There are smaller places that sell their wares.
Yeah, so it's not like that. No, actually, dairies actually can be more restrictive. In some provinces, it's a monopoly. Like you have to get a license to grow, and you have a quota. You're only allowed to make this much. Hmm. Whereas here, you can grow as much wheat or barley as you want. You just have to sell it all through the wheat board.
Poor extra cows with their contraband milk.
Well, we can get into the whole idea of raw milk, too. That's another growing issue out there about how... unpasteurized milk is somehow better for you because it's got more...
TB.
Yeah.
Well, you said that farmers have long memories, eh?
Well, yes, you know, and like I say, they got really annoyed at the Liberal government over oil, and maybe this will be their way of getting rid of the Conservative government. I mean, a lot of people also don't know. I mean, there are Conservative governments in Western Canada, but, I mean, in Saskatchewan, you're not called a Conservative, you're not called a Progressive Conservative. They have Progressive parties, but it's the Saskatchewan Party. Mm-hmm. And again, because if you get a certain label, it can be the kiss of death for you.
Well, we'll have to see how that develops in the future. Let's go to another commercial break here on Radio Free Thinker, and we'll be back after this.
Then there's the utter misery that is college radio, where they apparently just let any bewildered freshman wander into the booth and try to run a radio station. Campus Outreach is looking for... Hang on. College radio can pretty much be summed up in five words.
CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Standing on a planet. Really, I'm just a speck. I'm just a speck compared with a star.
Radio Free Thinker is broadcast Tuesdays at 3:30 p.m. on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. You can also hear us Mondays at 8 a.m. on UMFM 101.5 FM in Winnipeg, Fridays at 3 p.m. on CFBX 92.5 FM in Kamloops, and Saturdays at 9 a.m. on CKXU 88.3 FM in Lethbridge. Our thanks to all the stations that broadcast Radio Free Thinker and help promote skepticism and critical thinking. If you would like to have Radio Free Thinker syndicated on your local station, please email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
And we're back on Radio Free Thinker.
So, we've been talking a lot about wheat.
And the gold and money behind it.
Yeah, and that, you know, that prairie gold that's hanging out and making different... people different amounts of money now, potentially. However, I'd like to talk to something else with a bit of a golden bent to it. So hang on, we're going to delve into a little bit of mathematics.
Oh.
I feel like Donald Duck in Mathland. Did you guys ever see that show?
No.
Oh, you should totally go out and rent it. I feel that it's probably only on VHS, but it was a really good show. You can picture square roots and whatnot. However, today we're going to be talking about the golden section, the golden proportion, the golden mean. You can pick your name.
No, it's just not a sort of a family show. Never mind.
Yeah. We're just going to assume that you meant the golden rule. Anyhow, I'd like to do a little poking around this curious and literally irrational number and examine what it is, where it shows up, how we use it, and the science and skepticism behind us finding it everywhere. So, the golden section, what is it? The shortest answer to this question is it's actually just a number. I don't mean just a number, as we'll talk about. So, specifically, the golden mean is an irrational number. And this does not mean that the number has trouble thinking clearly and making good decisions, but rather that it can't be written as a fraction. When you see one number above another number separated by a line. So this is also known as a ratio, so irrational.
I thought when you had one number over another one, that was math class warfare.
Yeah. I'm just going to gloss over that one. So practically what this means is that the golden proportion, like pi, which many of us are familiar with, is a number with an endless stream of digits after the decimal place. Also, of course, this means that you can impress girls at parties by wowing them with how you've memorized it to the nth decimal place.
And you know you're a nerd if you really think that would wow mates at a party by listing off decimal places.
Or depending on the kind of partner you're after. But also like pi, the golden ratio is associated with a nice, trite, simple monosyllabic Greek character. So this is phi. For those of you whose togas are at the dry cleaner, that's the one that looks like a capital I with a circle drawn around its
and
middle.
And that's phi, P-H-I, as opposed to pi, which is just...
P-I. Yeah, so pi, relates different parts of the circle, and phi is what we're going to be referring to as the golden proportion. So for those members of our audience who like actual digits, the, quote, golden section is understood to... be equal to about 0.618, while phi represents the inverse of this number, and it's around 1.618. 618.
I was looking online and they had a neat little graphic of how you would do represent this as a fraction, and it was like 1 plus 1 over 1 plus 1 over plus 1 plus 1 over ad infinitum.
Well, and that's the thing about this number, is that actually has a lot of interesting properties like that as far as nested proportionalities and that kind of thing. And we'll talk a little bit about that. We won't go into too much math because I don't have a blackboard and radio is sort of difficult for that. But that is what makes this number so fantastic from a mathematical point of view. It really has some very, very special characteristics. So as far as talking about the golden section and phi being 0.618 or 1.618, I'll pretty much use them interchangeably. And because of a lot of these special properties, this works out pretty well. So before I start really delving into the properties of this special number, I'd like to put out the disclaimer that I really am in no way a mathematician. I actually was planning on potentially becoming a mathematician until I figured out that I wasn't particularly good at it. But I will try my best today not to mispresent the math throughout this discussion. So there are a lot of ways to describe phi mathematically, as we were sort of talking about, and a lot of them either involve algebraic equations or visual representations. The latter, which are probably more intuitive for the majority of listeners, including myself. So my favorite way to explain phi visually is a number describing a situation of continuous balanced proportionality, which I was sort of alluding to before. So for example, it's the only way, if you have a piece of string, to cut that string such that the ratio of the length of the smaller piece to the bigger piece is the same as the bigger piece to the whole string before you cut it. So mathematically, this is described as the equation A over B equals B over A plus B. So again, I won't go into too many equations, but it's sort of, again, these nested proportionalities as you go down the line. It's also really mathematically important for being the only solution to the equation X squared equals X plus 1. As well as, if anyone's ever heard of the Fibonacci series, it's the limit to the ratio between any two consecutive numbers in that series.
Good. I was going to jump ahead and I was going to talk about architecture, but you go into the aesthetic.
We'll talk about that a little bit later. So, and you may be wondering at this point, who cares about how a line is cut up and maybe cares more about architecture. But we're going to talk a little bit about where this might show up in our lives. So although the line example is a good way to explain what the ratio is, it's obviously a very basic principle, and it can be used to build all kinds of other shapes and forms. So for example, we have the so-called golden spiral, and this is the only spiral shape that looks exactly the same no matter how far you zoom in or zoom out on it. There's also golden rectangles, golden triangles, features really prominently in pentagons and pentagrams and all kinds of other shapes. And these are really intimately related to the golden mean. So every time you see a pentagon or a pentagram, you may never have realized it in your life, but what you're actually seeing is a very sort of intimate relationship of the different lines by this number phi. So there are some excellent diagrams in the review article, All That Glitters, a review of psychological research on the aesthetics of the golden section, which was written by Christopher D. Green, if you want to check them out. So these basic shapes can in turn be used to make up more and more complex shapes and things, even things perhaps like people and galaxies and quasi-crystals.
And people were never quasi-crystals, because it was on the Science Sunday about 2 weeks back, I talked about them.
As well as we talked about it in the context of the Nobel laureates that were just revealed. So let's talk a little bit about the golden mean and where we find it in the physical world, so the world that we don't create, ostensibly. So in biology, there are several examples of this. So the intriguing thing about the golden mean is that it is not only really important in lots of mathematical models, but it shows up in the real world in a very practical sense. So I don't know how many nautiluses or abalone or tritons, which are all sea creatures, are interested in algebra or geometry. But many of these sea creatures do grow shells that actually are in the characteristic golden spiral pattern. And it's very, very accurate.
So is this like some kind of mystical thing then?
Well, I think we might talk a little bit about that later as far as how we can interpret finding these things everywhere. I'm just sort of, you can probably hear how amazed I am that it shows up everywhere. So the same spiral can be found in pine cones, pineapples, and sunflower seed growth patterns. Likewise, many, many, many plants use pentagonal symmetry. And we talked about how this pentagon is really closely related to the number. The Fibonacci series that I mentioned can also describe population growth patterns of different species such as bees and rabbits. And these numbers have a really close mathematical ties again to the golden section. So I'd just like to draw your attention to the fact that, yeah, you know, we see this in physical representations, in these shells, in these plants. And then it can describe not only physical forms in nature, but physical phenomena like population growth. So not, you know, what does the rabbit look like, but how fast is this population growing in comparison to bees that have a completely different lifestyle and you would not expect them to be related, but they are related by the golden section.
And you're not implying that it's limited to rabbits and bees?
I'm not. Those are the ones that have been studied. Well, there's many others that have been studied, but those are the ones that classic examples that have been studied directly in relation to the golden proportion. So many people have also suggested that humans and other animals exhibit proportions that are close to the golden mean. So for example, if you take a look at your finger, your index finger, or really any other finger, the ratio of the length of the knuckles, or the length of the finger segments that are separated by the knuckles follow this ratio. So, you know, the part where your nail is about the same to the middle section of your finger as that section is to a larger part of your finger. So these claims, however, are sort of hard to investigate because they involved assumed ideal ratios for a species that we're sort of moving toward or moving around. But as we'll talk about a little later, our affinity for this ratio can actually be used to design ideal body parts. So there's also a lot of occurrences of phi in non-biological sciences that are nonetheless part of the natural world. So we see shapes of related to the golden ratio in things like tropical hurricanes and spiral galaxies actually often spiral in a golden or logarithmic spiral. Not all spiral galaxies adopt the shape, but a bunch of them. So again, it's showing up in these things that are seemingly very disparate in nature and things that you wouldn't expect to be mathematically related, and yet they are. I know. So, you know, we have all these things that seem to be really ruled by the same deep mathematical principles. Which brings us to a short discussion on quasicrystals. Now, we had talked about this, again, as one of the things that had come out in the recent Nobel Awards, the existence of a quasicrystalline substance. So, again, this is one of these sort of counterintuitive manifestations of the golden ratio, and it's between the molecules that make up quasicrystalline material. So, it turns out that the golden ratio is important in how the molecules are arranged and actually integral to the property of being a quasicrystal. So peak ratios and X-ray diffraction patterns of quasicrystals are related by the golden mean. So while regular crystals have evenly spaced molecules, and that's sort of the definition of a regular crystal, molecules in a quasicrystal aren't spaced at these regular intervals, but are intervals that are related to each other by the golden ratio. And it turns out this is actually one of the definitive properties of being defined as a quasicrystal.
And it's actually this sort of numeric trick that allows quasicrystals to be stable, even though, again, almost intuitively you say, well, they'd have to be unstable because they're not regular and you need regularity for stability. And you go, well, they are regular in an irregular way.
Yeah, it's as opposed to having a defined space between the molecules, the spaces are defined by a ratio of the different distances, as opposed to an absolute distance. So let's talk a little bit about the aesthetics of the Golden Mean. I have very, very sort of tangentially mentioned that this is sort of something that's considered beautiful, and you might even get it from the name Golden Proportion. But the case has been argued over and over that objects that reflect the golden ratio are intrinsically pleasing from an aesthetic point of view. Knowledge of the Golden Mean existed in Egypt, and ancient Egypt, not Egypt today, although they still have it.
I imagine they still do know about it today.
Yeah, they do.
That'd be kind of weird if they didn't.
Yeah, yeah, although, you know, we lost all kinds of things from Egypt that we haven't got back.
That's true.
But then this knowledge was also passed along in turn to different ancient civilizations and has really been around for a while. So historical figures such as Euclid and Vitruvius are recorded as referencing the wonderful properties of this number. James Sully included the first English language use of the term golden section in his article on aesthetics, of all things, in the 1875 edition of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So it really had some juice behind it. So it's been called the most beautiful ratio, and whether by accident or on purpose, humans have used their knowledge of this number to create works of art of all kinds. So there's evidence of this number shows up in architecture in ancient Egypt. Leonardo da Vinci illustrated the book De Divina Proportione, there we go, by Luca Pacioli di Brogo, and also used this proportion heavily in many of his own works. That's Leonardo da Vinci did. People have even made claims that the division points of major symphonic works in music do also conform to this ratio. So in a modern twist to this aesthetic appeal, plastic surgeons and most often cosmetic dentists have actually consciously used this proportion to sell their clients the most perfectly beautiful smile.
Yeah, going back to what I was going to say about architecture earlier, is I was watching, I think it was a show called The Day the Universe Changed, mm-hmm. by James Burke, with wonderful series, you guys should watch it. But they were talking about one of the great, part of the Renaissance was the rebirth of architecture, and one of the big things in that was using this golden mean in designing. So if you ever look at a lot of the quote-unquote classic Greek structures, Roman structures of the 1400s, 1500s, the bottom floor will be like, you know, 2.5 stories high, and the second floor will be like a story high, and these are all done based on this golden rule proportion system.
Well, and it's a little bit hard to tease out whether things are on purpose or by accident in lots of the more nebulous applications. So for something like that, it's kind of obvious, like, okay, these people knew what they were measuring. But a lot of the time, it sort of gives you pause to wonder, did people do this on purpose, or did they do it by accident because they themselves found it beautiful?
Was it the chicken or the egg thing?
Exactly. Or is it more like, did you do it in full knowledge, or did you do it because of what it is?
Well, that leads into something that you don't really talk about earlier on, but I mean, is there like an evolutionary advantage towards this? And if there was, it would seem natural, like humans have a taste for sugar and that sort of thing, mm-hmm. because it's good for us, that this proportion somehow represents good health or a safe harbor or who knows what. And that's why we have this sort of predilection for it.
Well, and it also sort of, again, many people have argued that the human body, as well as the body of many other things, are actually grown in with their body parts approximately in these proportions. So it would make some sort of sense that humans being intrinsically egotistical creatures, that we would find things beautiful that are sort of made in our image. However, that presupposes the fact that we would be made in that proportion, which again is sort of has this assumption that there is an ideal proportion for human limbs and whatnot, which is a little bit trickier to argue.
I don't know. In my research for the show, I found out that apparently the ideal ratio for body length is 8 times your head. Classic literature says, apparently, you know, some
of the
research into this, and apparently the average person is about 7.5 times their head length as far as how tall they are on average. Whereas if you look at classic body structures from literature, it always works out to be roughly 8 head lengths.
That's not what Barbie told me. So
we digress.
Well, yeah, and one of the things to remember in studying when we find occurrences of this strong human tendency toward this ratio is this confirmation bias. So if we go looking for the golden proportion, you're gonna find it. It then becomes a process of untangling both the numbers and the motivations surrounding phi's true prevalence in nature and in the man-made world. So the importance of phi in basic mathematics is really hard to argue with. And I mentioned several robust examples of it in the natural world, but there are a lot more tenuous examples as we've sort of been talking about. So finding ratios that are, you know, really close to it, finding it in a painting, is it a coincidence? Does it occur more frequently than other ratios? How many other ratios are reflected in the same object? You know, is it overrepresented? And as far as finding phi really is a prevalent component of a work of art or of a man-made thing, again, is this on purpose? Did the creator of this work incorporate the ratio explicitly, or was it more a consequence of the unconscious aesthetic appreciation that may or may not, again, have some kind of evolutionary advantage? And in that case, what the heck would that be? And what does the outcome say about the intrinsic value of this number to human consciousness? So there have been a lot of questions, and as people like to, when they discover questions, they like to try and answer them. So our interest in how we as humans perceive things expressing the golden ratio is ancient, and scientific research into phi-related psychology specifically is some of the earliest empirical studies conducted in psychology, period. Which I find really interesting. It's like one of the first things that we decide to do when we start to probe our brains is to probe why we're fascinated with this number, or if we're fascinated with this number. So many scientific studies have suggested that people really do like things that conform to the golden ratio. So these are studies that are looking at whether or not we actually are drawn to it, or whether or not it's just sort of a number we recognize that then we're like, oh, well, we must be drawn to it because we know what it is. So various experiments have shown that when asked to choose their favorite thing, such as a single rectangle, from a group of other things, such as a bunch of rectangles that all look different, they tend to overwhelmingly prefer the thing which conforms most closely to phi. So, for example, there have been studies looking at really pared-down manifestations of phi, literally lines and rectangles, all the way up to measuring landmarks on human faces and assigning them a number based on how closely they conform to the golden ratio. So basically scoring people's faces as far as conformity to this number. And then asking people, other people, to rate their level of attractiveness and correlating it with those phi correlation scores. So at first, a lot of the research was sort of set out to prove that people did have an affinity for things that conform to this number. However, lately, a lot of the research has gone into trying to prove that humans don't have an intrinsic response to the golden ratio, which is really handy because it provides a really balanced sort of approach to the research, and you can compare the different studies because they should all technically be unbiased in their... Well, people should be aiming for unbiasedness in their experimental approach. But having people that do have a hypothesis on either side of the fence is going to help balance out the field.
What are they going to do, though, when someone at some point points out that the number of studies done to show the relationship versus those that try to against the relationship
actually conforms to the golden ratio? Well, I think at that point, most of our brains will explode. So a lot of scientists have been taking a very skeptical look at the long-held assumption that people are able to recognize and subconsciously be affected by things conforming to this ratio, as I don't think that many people are going around with a ruler and consciously do it by measuring it, and then they decide they like it. So the alternative hypothesis is that people don't have an intrinsic ability to pick out this ratio, but that as a society, like we're saying, we understand its prevalence and then have a somewhat superstitious belief that it's beautiful. According to Dr. Green, the jury is, unsurprisingly, as so many of the things I talk about, still out. So while many groups have gone into this type of research with each opposing hypothesis, there appears to be no strong consensus as to whether people really are drawn to things with phi proportionality or whether it's just more or less a number that our society knows about. Dr. Green also brings up the point that if the effect is genuine, we're even further from knowing whether it falls on the nature or nurture side of biology. That is, again, whether This preference is from a psychological or a learned psychological part of ourself. So one of the reasons that I wanted to talk about the golden ratio, as Dawn brought up at the very beginning of the talk, is that I think it represents a very interesting experiment in the way that you can look at things that seem significant.
Proof of God.
So, well, that's one of the things, right? So this thing shows up everywhere, legitimately, in all places in math and nature and general universe, you know. We're talking about things that show up in physical molecules, in galaxies, and then in biological phenomena. So this fact can really be looked at in two skeptically opposite ways. As you're saying, it, you know, this has been one approach to think about it is it's been worked into the fabric of the universe by some cognizant being. This is proof of some kind of cosmic consciousness that's using the same signature in different parts of the universe.
The lazy God, then.
Maybe.
You know, it comes up with one sort of tagline.
Yeah.
It works.
It's a good cookie cutter God. Okay. And then the other way, which is, I argue, and probably everyone would argue, a bit more skeptical, is that there's something about the way this number corresponds with relationships between things that can tell us something about the fundamental laws of the universe that we live in. So basically, no, it's not an accident that this happened. No, it's not a design that this happened. But there is a physical reason that is going to give us a greater insight than just God could by looking at it a little bit closer.
Yeah, no, but that complicates the whole matter with, you know, I need to actually understand things. If I just sit there and I say, golden ratio, cool, proof of God, period, stop, let's go watch the football game. Whereas what you're kind of implying is that this ratio somehow is giving us insight into more questions about the universe, and we may actually learn more about the universe, and that's going to keep me away from my game.
It really will. No, for sure. I mean, if you ever go looking for answers, you're going to find questions. If we've learned anything about, you know, talking about science and scientific discoveries on this show, it's that there are always more questions than answers. Also, with the golden proportion question, there is the extra layer of aesthetics. So in this case, we also have to consider that when we do encounter this ratio, we seem to find it pleasing. So again, a non-skeptical view of this might be that we are recognizing this signature of this cosmic creator that made us using this nice cookie cutter formula, and that we are appreciating that signature. However, a more skeptical viewpoint might be to ask first if we find it intrinsically pleasing, which so many scientists are asking, and then why? So again, it's the difference between explaining it away with mysticism and questioning, and the alternative of actually questioning whether there is something more to be learned from the observation that we could actually explore scientifically and gain real insight. So encountering something that seems mystical at first glance can be an amazing scientific discovery. It's all in how you deal with that discovery and whether you choose to sort of dismiss it or whether you choose to use it. So it's often the things that don't fit our current models that we consider magic. Historically, it's happened over and over. So when really it's the opportunity to expand the model through understanding this new phenomenon that just sort of breaks the mold of it. So some people argue that this is making, you know, sort of taking the magic out of life, and will take offense to this. But the more you understand something and the more you understand our world, I'm telling you, it's awesome.
I've heard it said that the real world is amazing.
True that. Are you kidding? With Phi showing up everywhere? I mean, seriously, I still have this sense of wonderment over the types of variety that some, you know, when people think that math doesn't touch their real life, it's examples like this that really make you understand that even if you don't realize it, how much is really going under the surface in these deep principles that people don't understand why we study them.
And I think actually, too, you get that whole idea that everyone says, well, you know, science somehow makes me feel insignificant. But in an odd sort of way, it kind of connects you as part of the whole big tapestry of everything. I mean, yeah. You're not insignificant. You are an integral part. You are a representation of the whole right in yourself. I mean, yeah. Everyone, you know, I am made in God's image. Well, it's even more profound to say I am made in the universe's image.
Yeah, I am part of the same fabric and ruled by the same laws. And understanding each part helps us understand the whole.
And if I could just break that, I could destroy the universe.
Oh, please don't. Okay. I like it. Didn't I just mention it's amazing?
Yeah.
It's a nice universe. It's a nice universe.
Oh, I see. Yes. It's a good universe. It's a nice universe. I wouldn't say it's a great universe.
Well, I mean, I don't have unlimited control space and time. That would make it pretty cool.
I'll ask you this. Have you ever seen a better universe?
In my dreams, maybe. But we're running out of time here on Radio Freethinker. We should go to our skeptical highlights. I have an interesting one. As people know, today is November 1st, and you might see folks walking around with poppies on their jackets or whatever. This is to commemorate the end of the First World War, which happened on November 11th, 1918. Nowadays, people will wear poppies to symbolize the terrible toll that war takes wherever it's fought. So I encourage you to pick up a poppy and also open up a history book and take some time to reflect on things past.
I think I will reiterate that particular thing. We had a bit of a, well, for a fake discussion beforehand about some people will try and turn Remembrance Day into something that's sort of a political anti-war sort of campaign. And, I mean, you can do that, but you really got to kind of shoehorn it in there. And really, at the heart of this, it's just that some people have done great things to help make the world a better place, that we need to remember the horrors of the past, otherwise we risk repeating them. And it's just a great way to sort of say, you know, war sucks, and I just want to let everyone know that I support people who try to stop wars.
Well, it's also, I think, a great way to just express sympathy. I mean, you know, you don't have to be a rah-rah kind of person to appreciate this. If you just have ever seen pictures of what people went through in war, you know, making a small gesture to show that, hey, I care about these people and I hope it doesn't happen again, I think is a really powerful statement.
So, I have one. Actually, this is something that's kind of just breaking at the moment, so some of this will be a bit scratchy, but it's roughly what I'd like to call something about inappropriate political pressure. Just recently, UNESCO, which is a part of the UN, voted to have as a member Palestine and support their bid for statehood at the UN. The Obama administration, Obama, the Nobel Peace Prize winner, announced immediately after the vote that the UN is suspending payments of $60 million a month in dues that the U.S. owes to UNESCO. Our own Foreign Affairs Minister, John Baird, said Canada is considering a response that may fall suit by not paying our own $10 million. Why is this interesting? Well, at first, Canada, U.S., we tend to have a different double standard when it comes to nations in conflict. But I think it also shows that although Canada in principle professes to support democracies, whenever the results don't seem to be something in our liking, we always try to attempt to sort of subvert, quote, will of the people, be that as it may, to force the vote into the way we like it, be it Gaza elections or the UN voting for statehood. I mean, this is a vote of, quote, unquote, equal nations, and everyone should be able to exercise it. And if we don't like what you said, well, we're going to pack up our balls and go home and not play anymore, which strikes me as a very sort of anti-democratic sort of thing to do. But really the thing that struck me here is, like, is this really the fight you want to pick? Whatever your stances are on the political issues, for those of you who don't know, UNESCO is the United Nations Education, Science, and Cultural Organization. These are the people who are responsible for World Heritage Sites, the International Council of Science. I believe they're involved in the International Panel on Climate Change. They support World Press Freedom Day. One of their core issues is the eradication of illiteracy in the world. This is where you want to cut funding. So, I mean, sure, we may not have been happy with the vote, and there are ways that we may protest the vote if you don't agree with it, but this just struck me as a really stupid thing, and it's constantly developing right now. We haven't, Canada itself hasn't said whether we're going to withdraw our due payments or not. So I would encourage those people, whatever you view one way or the other, is to contact your local MP and our illustrious Forest Minister and tell them, A, how you feel, but B, don't shoot this particular organization in the foot that seems to be doing so much good for what it actually does on the ground.
Okay, well, we're out of time. So this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening.
This is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Jenna reminding you that the real world is amazing.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise. A morning filled with 400 billion suns. The rising of the Milky Way. The cosmos is full.